pace of events, whether fast or slow. Let me just pause for a moment. The answer here is not just decide quickly. And we're going to return to this. This is one of the most surprising findings in the study. In a fast-paced world, you do not always want to make fast decisions. You want to go slow when you can and fast when you must. Hang on to that. We'll come back to it. On the other side, behaviors that correlate with unsuccessful outcomes is when you fail to adjust your speed of decision to the pace of events, either deciding too slowly or too fast, depending on the situation. Now let's go to another successful behavior, or a behavior that correlates with good outcomes, and that's making deliberate, fact-driven decisions. Highly disciplined thought, even if you're moving quickly. And an unsuccessful behavior is reactive, impulsive decisions, lacking any fanatic discipline and strategic rigor. And then finally, on the successful side, we see a focus on superb execution once decisions are made. And this might mean increasing your intensity to meet time demands, but without ever compromising excellence. Just because the world is moving quickly, just because you face a threat that is coming at you really fast, does not mean you should compromise the excellence of your execution. That's a good way to get killed. It'd be like rushing up a side of a mountain because a storm is coming quickly and then tying your knots poorly and they come untied. And we look over at the unsuccessful outcomes. We see a behavior of compromising in excellence of execution for the sake of speed, and a failure to increase the intensity needed to attain superb execution when moving fast. Okay, I've just thrown a whole bunch at you here. For the rest of this chapter, a number of these ideas are going to be fleshed out with some stories and some ways of helping you grasp them. Our analysis yielded a much more nuanced perspective than always go faster. We concluded that recognizing a change or threat early and then taking the time available, whether that be short or long, to make a rigorous and deliberate decision yields better outcomes than just making a bunch of quick decisions. Now, wherever you are, I'm going to give you an absolutely crucial question for attaining great outcomes in a turbulent, unstable, fast-moving, unpredictable environment. Ingrain this question in your brains. Use it constantly. The key question turns out not to be, should we be fast to act or slow? The key question is this: how much time before our risk profile changes? Let me repeat that. I want this in your brain. How much time before our risk profile changes? Recall Andy Grove's response to his cancer diagnosis that we discussed earlier in Chapter 2. Grove didn't jump right to action. He considered his time frame and recognized that his risk profile wouldn't change significantly in a matter of days or weeks. Months or years, yes, but not weeks. He then used that time to rigorously develop a plan of attack, considering all the various possibilities and creating his own data charts. Grove was anything but complacent about his cancer, but he didn't make a quick, reactive decision. Grove believed that jumping into the operating room without carefully considering his situation and the options would increase his risk. Sometimes acting too fast increases risk. Sometimes acting too slow increases risk. The critical question again is how much time before your risk profile changes. Do you have seconds, minutes, hours, days, weeks, months, years, decades Which? The primary difficulty lies not in answering the question, but in having the presence of mind to ask the question. And one of the more surprising findings, the 10X teams tended to take their time to let events unfold when the risk profile was changing slowly. Yet equally, they prepared to act blindingly fast in the event the risk profile began to change rapidly. Prior to the mid-1990s, Stryker kept a vigilant eye on a storm brewing far off in the distance, noting in its 1989 annual report that the United States would become competitively disadvantaged if healthcare costs were to rise to more than 15% of GNP. This, in turn, could lead to a backlash on costs and drive down prices on Stryker's medical devices. Stryker squirreled away a whole bunch of oxygen canisters, cash on the balance sheet, to handle whatever form the disruption might take. Still, John Brown did not act early. He let the situation unfold, prepared to act fast when the time came. Then in the late 1990s, Stryker's risk profile began to change rapidly when hospital buying groups emerged to concentrate their buying power. These groups preferred to deal with a few large market leaders, and in response, the industry began to consolidate in a series of rapid-fire acquisitions. Medical device companies faced a stark choice: become one of the few largest players with economies of scale, or be largely shut out of the game. And when the risk profile began to change, and it began to change very quickly, that is when Stryker swooped in, bought Halmedica, and ensured itself one of the top three seats. So let's pause for a moment, look at the Stryker case, through the lens of those four behaviors I described a few minutes ago that correlate with good outcomes. We had the behavior of hypervigilance, constant worry about changes that might signal danger, recognizing threats early. And we look over at Stryker. Back in the 1980s, Stryker explicitly identified rising healthcare costs as a concern and worried about industry disruptions that might result. They didn't act, but they sure worried and they sure kept an eye on it. Let's take the behavior of adjusting decisions to the speed and pace of events, whether fast or slow. Go slow when you can, fast when you must. So we go back to the 1980s and early 1990s, and Stryker took no dramatic action, yet considered options and built large cash reserves so that it could act fast when it needed to. Then we go to the behavior of making deliberate, fact-driven decisions, highly disciplined, even if you're moving quickly. And we go to the late 1990s. When buying groups drove the industry into that rapid consolidation, creating a brutal fact, you're either at the table or you're not at the table. And that's when Stryker made a very disciplined decision to buy Halmedica. And then finally, the behavior of focusing on superb execution once decisions are made, increasing your intensity as needed to meet time demands without compromising excellence. And we go over to Stryker from 1998 to 1999. Stryker team members worked nearly nonstop, incredible intensity, 7 days a week for months, to successfully integrate Halmedica. As a productive paranoid, and I sure hope after listening to this book, after engaging with this chapter, that you proudly wear the patch on your arm, "I am a productive paranoid." As a productive paranoid, you want to be cognizant of lurking dangers and vigilant about possible disruptions. But this is very different from taking quick, immediate action because you want the anxiety and uncertainty to go away. In our executive laboratory, we've noticed that some leaders from emerging markets maintain a very calm stance in the face of uncertainty, including a willingness to let time pass when the risk profile remains stable. During the 2008-2009 financial crisis, we worked directly with some of the most successful business leaders from emerging markets. And we noticed their calm and considered countenance in the face of swirling tumult. One of the most successful self-made business leaders from Latin America who achieved his success in a brutally uncertain environment described his ability to pause. Sure, he said, it's human nature to want to make the uncertainty go away. But that desire can lead you to decide quickly, sometimes too quickly. Where I come from, he continued, you soon realize that uncertainty will never go away, no matter what decisions we make or actions we take. So if we have time to let the situation unfold, giving us more clarity before we act, we take that time. Of course, when the time comes, he reminded, you need to be ready to act. So one of the most dangerous false beliefs is that faster is always better. That the fast always beat the slow. That you are either the quick or the dead. Well, sometimes the quick are the dead. Productive Paranoia Part 3. Zoom out, then zoom in. In a famous experiment, researchers Daniel J. Simons and Christopher F. Chabris asked subjects to watch a videotape of people passing a basketball back and forth and count the number of passes. Partway through the video, a person in a gorilla suit unexpectedly walks right into the middle of the action, thumps its chest, and walks off the court. Focused on their counting task, only 50% of the subjects even noticed the gorilla. We spend most of our lives dealing with the plans and activities right in front of us, ticking tasks off our lists, clicking past mile markers on our big projects, responding to the incessant demands on our time. And we can easily miss the gorilla right in front of us. 10X leaders, however, don't miss the gorilla, especially if the gorilla poses a dangerous threat. David Rashears was utterly focused on getting his IMAX camera to the summit of Everest. Yet when he looked down the mountain on May 8, 1996, the swarm of humanity heading his way, he saw a huge gorilla. We adopted the terms zoom out and zoom in to capture an essential manifestation of productive paranoia, a dual lens capability. 10X leaders remain obsessively focused on their objectives and hypervigilant about changes in their environment. They push for perfect execution and adjust to changing conditions. Put another way, they count the passes and see the gorilla. So in practice, it works like this. You sense a change in conditions and you zoom out. You assess the time frame. You ask how much time before the risk profile changes. And you assess with rigor as you're zooming out. Do the new conditions call for disrupting plans? And if so, how? And after you've sort of zoomed out, you then zoom in and focus on supreme execution of plans and objectives. Notice that the question, that really critical question that we want in your brain, how much time before the risk profile changes, is part of the zoom out. As we discussed earlier, 10Xers took the time available to zoom out and formulate a considered response. Of course, sometimes the 10X cases had to act fast when the risk profile was changing rapidly, when the gorilla was already close and charging fast. Even so, they avoided panicky, reactive decisions. They remained deliberate and clear-headed, responding fast enough. On December 4, 1979, a special task force of six Intel managers and external marketing guru Regis McKenna set aside their lives for three full days of intense discussions, sparked by an 8-page telex from field engineer Don Buckow, who'd written an incisive and desperate analysis of Intel's weakening position with its 8086 microprocessor relative to the Motorola 68000. Of particular concern, Motorola had begun to pull ahead of Intel in competition for important design wins. Convincing customers to design the Motorola 68000 into their product lines. It was a terrifying trend. If Motorola gained a dominant share of design wins, it could entrench itself as a standard, becoming increasingly difficult to unseat. As Intel manager William H. Davido reflected in his book, Marketing in High Technology, Intel was headed for obscurity. The Intel team zoomed out. Why is Motorola winning? How important is this? How can we counter? The team developed a 5-point competitive positioning strategy and a schedule focusing on Intel's distinctive capability Intel delivers and its capacity to provide an entire family of chips, generation upon generation of chips, giving customers comfort. The resulting document was smart and strategic, reflecting deep insight into Intel's strengths and an understanding of what customers really worried about. Based on a very systematic analysis, in 3 days, the team developed a plan of counterattack dubbed Operation Crush. Then Intel zoomed in. The task force finished its work on Friday, less than a week after it convened, and Intel approved the plan and allocated a multi-million-dollar budget the following Tuesday. Within the week, more than 100 Crush team members sporting buttons with bold orange letters C-R-U-S-H met at the San Jose Hyatt. From there, they fanned out across the globe to garner 2,000 design wins for Intel within a year. Intel was on a self-described crusade, turning the tide and getting its 2,000 design victories, including a really big one for IBM's future PC personal computer. Despite being in a fast-moving, perilous, competitive situation, the Intel team took a very deliberate approach, formulating a smart and rigorous strategy. Intel initiated Operation Crush in just 7 days, yet did so with fiercely disciplined thought. When facing fast-moving threats, 10X teams neither freeze up nor immediately react. They think first, even when they need to think fast. Intel made a mistake in not recognizing the Motorola threat earlier. Again, even 10X companies do not have a perfect record, which forced it into such a crash program. Yet once it recognized the threat, it didn't make its situation worse via panicky, thoughtless reaction. 10X enterprises at their best respond to empirical evidence rather than hype or scaremongering and stick with proven principles and strategies in the face of frightening events. A fast-moving threat does not call for abandoning disciplined thought and disciplined action. By early 1987, George Rathman had convinced the Amgen board to fire a cannonball on its breakthrough product, EPO. Recognizing the moment, the science is done, the trials are done, we have the product ready, the clock is ticking, we've got to go now. The Amgen FDA application team turned themselves into the Simi Valley hostages. At first, they worked at the office, but soon decided that they needed to block out all distractions, recognizing that nothing was more important at this moment than the FDA filing, pushing everything else into the it can wait pile, moving copiers and working files into motel rooms at the Posada Royale Quality Inn in Simi Valley, cutting off normal life, embracing a brutal, non-stop schedule, smiling as their friends and colleagues hung yellow ribbons in their honor. They'd work in the morning, take a brief lunch break, work until 6 p.m., take a short dinner break, work into the night, then repeat again, day after day, week after week. Finally, 93 days later, they loaded the 19,578-page document into a rented truck, drove it to the airport, and shipped it off to the FDA. A large bedsheet adorned with yellow ribbons was hung outside Amgen's headquarters proclaiming, "The Simi Valley hostages are free." The Simi Valley hostages had a lot of catching up to do on their lives. If you don't get your desk cleaned off for 93 days, or your garage repainted, or your marathon run, your golf game in, your expense reports completed, your phone calls returned, your mail answered, your vacation achieved, your new house bought, your newspapers read, or pretty much anything else that can wait until later, what does it matter? Compared to missing the chance to secure EPO with the FDA before another competitor. The Simi Valley hostages understood that they were in a race to be first. But they didn't sacrifice their detailed, methodical approach for the sake of speed. By increasing their intensity to extreme levels for a time, nothing else matters until we get this done and done right. They went fast enough to win. In contrast, consider how Genentech failed to execute as well in a comparable moment and how that failure contributed to Genentech losing its independence. On Friday afternoon, May 29, 1987, 400 people gathered in the FDA auditorium in Bethesda, Maryland, to witness Genentech's presentation to an FDA advisory panel on its new drug, TPA, also known as Activase. No drug up to that point in the history of biotechnology had generated anything like the excitement around TPA, a wonder drug designed to dissolve clots in heart attack victims. Genentech's stock price, trading at 100 times earnings, reflected Genentech's salesmanship in convincing people that the TPA cannonball would smash directly into its target, hype that had left the stock vulnerable in the event that TPA encountered snags with the FDA. Around dinner time, after 5 hours of presentations and discussions, the committee chair finally asked for a vote. The audience gasped when it heard the count. Genentech hadn't convinced the committee that TPA prolonged life, and the committee recommended that TPA should be sent back for further study. Ironically, Genentech actually had access to most of the information needed to convince the FDA. But it didn't have all the necessary data readily available and prepared in an unassailable way for whatever concerns and questions might have come from the committee on the day of the meeting. Genentech's founder, Robert Swanson, called the committee's decision a mistake. And to be fair, Genentech did return later that year and obtained a positive decision. Still, those 6 months mattered, with at least 10 companies racing to create TPA-related drugs. And those competitors gained ground, while Genentech retreated to reassemble its data for the FDA. The TPA setback helped to puncture Genentech's high-flying stock price, which fell more than 60% behind the general stock market in the subsequent 2 years, raising the cost of equity capital, which Genentech needed to invest heavily in R&D, and leading the company to sell a controlling stake to Roche. Not all time in life is equal. We close this chapter with a twist to the Amundsen story that highlights the importance of being able to zoom out, then zoom in. It turns out that Amundsen hadn't planned to go to the South Pole in 1911. He'd planned to go to the North Pole. That's right, the North Pole. He'd raised money to go to the North Pole, assembled a team for the North Pole, gained access to the ship Fram for a trip to the North Pole, and mapped a full plan for the North Pole. So then, how did he end up at the opposite end of the Earth at the South Pole? While making his preparations for the North, Amundsen received crushing news. The North Pole had fallen. First Cook, then Perry, had reportedly reached 90 degrees north. So Amundsen decided to redirect his expedition and channel his energies into preparing for a new destination, the South Pole. He kept his decision secret, even from his crew, during the months while he prepared until he set sail. On September 9, 1910, at the port of Madeira, Portugal, Amundsen raised anchor 3 hours ahead of schedule, catching his crew off guard. He assembled his men on deck and calmly told them that they weren't going to the North Pole after all, that the expedition would veer to the South Pole instead. Earlier in the day, the crew had nothing but the North Pole on their minds. By 10 p.m., they were already heading toward the South Pole, fully committed to the new adventure, the North Pole fading from their dreams. In all of the previous discussion that you've heard, we've portrayed Amundsen as anything but impulsive, the consummate, detail-oriented, super-prepared, monomaniacal, disciplined fanatic. Yet, with the North Pole gone, and the South in Scott's line of sight, Amundsen pivoted dramatically, changing direction from north to south. If Amundsen had said, well, my plan is to go north, so that's what I'm going to do. If he refused to reorient his focus, he would not have led his team to a 10X achievement. Upon learning that the North Pole had fallen, he zoomed out to consider the changed conditions. Then he zoomed in to execute a new plan to go south. 10Xers distinguish themselves by an ability to recognize defining moments that call for disrupting their plans, changing the focus of their intensity, and or rearranging their agenda because of opportunity or peril or both. When the defining moment comes, they have the buffers already in place. Lots of extra oxygen canisters, giving them options and flexibility to adjust. They have huge margins of safety precisely because they've bounded their risks, exercising prudence all the way along, avoiding death line risk, shunning asymmetric risk, and minimizing uncontrollable risk. They sense change, zooming out to ask how much time before the risk profile changes. They make rigorous rather than reactive decisions. Then they zoom in, obsessively focusing on superb execution in the defining moment, never compromising excellence for speed. Not all time in life is equal. Absorb that phrase. Let that one burrow into your brain. Not all time in life is equal. Life serves up some moments that count much more than other moments. The year 1911 was an unequal time for Amundsen, and he made the most of it. May 1996 on Everest was an unequal time for David Brashears. And he executed brilliantly when the time came. September 11 was an unequal time for the airline industry. And Southwest came through with the most inspired and defiant performance. We will all face moments when the quality of our performance matters much more than other moments. Moments that we can seize or squander. 10Xers prepare for those moments, recognize those moments, grab those moments, append their lives in those moments, and deliver their best in those moments. They respond to unequal times with unequal intensity when it matters most. Chapter summary. Leading above the death line. Key points. This chapter explores three key dimensions of productive paranoia. 1. Build cash reserves and buffers, oxygen canisters, to prepare for unexpected events and bad luck before they happen. 2. Bound risk, death line risk, asymmetric risk, and uncontrollable risk, and manage time-based risk. And 3, zoom out, then zoom in, remaining hypervigilant to sense changing conditions and respond effectively. 10Xers understand that they cannot reliably and consistently predict future events. So they prepare obsessively, ahead of time, all the time, for what they cannot possibly predict. They assume that a series of bad events can wallop them in quick succession, unexpectedly, and at any time. It's what you do before the storm hits. The decisions and disciplines and buffers and shock absorbers already in place that matters most in determining whether your enterprise pulls ahead, falls behind, or dies when the storm hits. 10Xers build buffers and shock absorbers far beyond the norm of what others do. The 10X companies we studied carried 3 to 10 times the ratio of cash to assets relative to the median of what most companies carry. And they maintained more conservative balance sheets than the comparison companies throughout their histories, even when they were small enterprises. 10X cases are extremely prudent in how they approach and manage risk, paying special attention to three categories of risk. 1, death line risk, which can kill or severely damage the enterprise. 2, asymmetric risk, in which the downside dwarfs the upside. And 3, uncontrollable risk, which cannot be controlled or managed. 10Xers zoom out, then zoom in. They focus on their objectives and sense changes in their environment. They push for perfect execution and adjust to changing conditions. When they sense danger, they immediately zoom out to consider how quickly a threat is approaching and whether it calls for a change in plans. Then they zoom in, refocusing their energies into executing objectives. Big point. Rapid change does not call for abandoning disciplined thought and disciplined action. Rather, it calls for upping the intensity to zoom out for fast yet rigorous decision making and zoom in for fast yet superb execution. Unexpected findings. The 10X cases took less risk than the comparison cases, yet produced vastly superior results. Contrary to the image of brazen, self-confident, risk-taking entrepreneurs who see only upside potential, 10X leaders exercise productive paranoia, obsessing about what can go wrong. They ask questions like, What is the worst case scenario? What are the consequences of the worst case scenario? Do we have contingencies in place for the worst case scenario? What's the upside and what's the downside of this decision? What's the likelihood of the upside and the downside? What's out of our control? How can we minimize our exposure to forces we can't control? And they always ask, what if, what if, what if, what if, what if? Remember that little phrase. They're almost paranoid neurotic freaks. The 10X cases didn't have a greater bias for speed than the comparison cases. Taking the time available before the risk profile changes, whether that be short or long, to make a rigorous and deliberate decision produces a better outcome than rushing a decision. And one key question for you. Regarding the biggest threats and dangers facing your enterprise, and even the opportunities it faces, how much time before the risk profile changes? Chapter 6, SMACK. That's a capital S, capital M, small a, capital C. Chapter quote, most men die of their remedies and not of their illnesses. Molière. Let's briefly reinforce the triangle we introduced in the 10Xer chapter. You've got the triangle with the three core 10Xer behaviors. The top of the triangle, fanatic discipline. The bottom right of the triangle, empirical creativity. The bottom left of the triangle, productive paranoia. The previous three chapters mapped directly to those. 20-mile march for fanatic discipline, fire bullets, then cannonballs for empirical creativity, and all the practices of leading above the death line for productive paranoia. This chapter, chapter 6, around the concept of SMACK and SMACK recipe, actually requires all three of these dimensions working together. So think of this as all three points on that triangle have lit up. In early 1979, Howard Putnam, then CEO of Southwest Airlines, wrestled with a question. Does the sweeping disruption of deregulation call for a revolution in how we run our company? The 1978 Airline Deregulation Act would unleash competition, throw carriers into pitched battles for market share, ignite price wars, force airlines to cut costs, and lead to bankruptcies. Putnam considered, does deregulation undermine our low-cost model? Does deregulation threaten our high-spirit, employee-focused culture? Does deregulation erode the competitive value of rapid gate turns or destroy the viability of our point-to-point system? Does radical change in our environment call for inflicting radical change upon ourselves? His answers? No, 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 and no. He concluded that Southwest should continue to expand based on, quote, the cookie-cutter approach, unquote. He conjured up the image of a recipe used repeatedly to create batches of consistently formed cookies. Do the same thing you are already doing well, he said, and do it over and over again. Not only that, he specified the cookie recipe point by point. I'm going to read you what he articulated in the recipe, verbatim, so that you can hear how he laid out the recipe in his own words. He enumerated the points, 1 through 10. 1. Remain a short-haul carrier under two-hour segments. 2. Utilize the 737 as our primary aircraft for 10 to 12 years. 3. Continued high aircraft utilization and quick turns, 10 minutes in most cases. 4. The passenger is our number one product. Do not carry air freight or mail. Only small packages which have high profitability and low handling costs. 5. Continued low fares and high frequency of service. 6. Stay out of food services. 7. No interlining. Costs in ticketing, tariffs, and computers and our unique airports do not lend themselves to interlining. 8. Retain Texas as our number one priority and only go interstate if high-density, short-haul markets are available to us. 9. Keep the family and people feeling in our service and a fun atmosphere aloft. We're proud of our employees. And 10. Keep it simple. Continue cash register tickets, 10-minute cancellation of reservations at the gate in order to clear standbys, simplified computer system, free drinks in executive service, free coffee and donuts in the boarding area, no seat selection on board, tape-recorded passenger manifest, bring airplanes and crews home to Dallas each night, only one domicile and maintenance facility. Now pause for a moment and just reflect on that list. What strikes you about it? Notice that Putnam didn't issue some bland, generic, Southwest Airlines will be a leading low-cost airline vacuous statement. He specified 2-hour segments. He specified 737s. He specified 10-minute turns. He specified no air, freight, or mail. He specified no food service. He specified no interlining. He specified no seat selection. He specified cash register receipts. Putnam's 10 points are easy to grasp, articulate, follow, and understand what to do and what not to do. Putnam laid out a clear, simple, and concrete framework for decisions and action. Notice also, Putnam's 10 points reflect insight based upon empirical validation. Remember our old friend, empirical validation, about what works. Take the idea of only 737s. Why would only 737s make sense? Why does that work? Well, all your pilots can fly all your jets, allowing for immense scheduling flexibility. You need only one set of parts, one set of training manuals, one set of maintenance procedures, one set of flight simulators, one type of jetway, one procedure for boarding. But the truly amazing thing about Putnam's list is its consistency over time. In total, the elements on the Putnam list, the ingredients in the recipe, changed only about 20% in a quarter of a century. Now just stop and think about that for a moment. Only a 20% change, despite a series of disruptive events, from fuel shocks to air traffic control strikes, massive industry mergers, the rise of the hub-and-spoke model, recessions, interest rate spikes, the internet, and 9/11. Yet, while stunningly consistent, the recipe also evolved, never through wholesale revolution, but in careful steps. Southwest did eventually add flights longer than 2 hours, embraced internet booking, and interlined with Iceland Air. If Southwest had become rigid, close-minded, uncurious, never amending Putnam's points, as needed, it would not have become a 10x case. Still, what most stands out is how much of the list Southwest kept intact. Smack recipe. Howard Putnam's 10 points form a smack recipe. A smack recipe is a set of durable operating practices that create a replicable and consistent success formula. The word SMAC, capital S, capital M, small a, capital C, stands for specific, methodical, and consistent. You can use the term SMAC as a descriptor in any number of ways. You can use it as an adjective. Let's build a smack system. As a noun, smack lowers risk. And as a verb, let's smack this project. A solid smack recipe is the operating code for turning broad strategic concepts into reality, a set of practices that are more enduring than mere tactics. See, tactics change from situation to situation, whereas smack practices can last for decades and apply across a wide range of circumstances. Morton and I used to believe in an inevitable trade-off between specificity and durability. If you want to have durable precepts to live by, we believe they needed to be more general, like core values or high-level strategy. But on the other hand, if you wanted specific practices, they needed to change frequently as conditions change, like tactics do. Yet, through this research, we learned that it is possible to develop practices that are both specific and durable. SMAC practices. A SMAC practice is not the same as a strategy, culture, core values, purpose, or tactics. Fly only 737s. Is fly only 737s a core value? No. Is fly only 737s a core purpose, a reason for being? No. Is fly only 737s a broad high-level strategy? No. Is fly only 737s a culture? No. Is fly only 737s a tactic to be changed frequently from situation to situation? No. Think about this. More than 30 years after Putnam laid out his 10 points, 30 years in an industry that has been upended time and again, Southwest still flew only 737s. A SMAC recipe also includes practices not to do. Putnam's list has clear not to do points. Don't interline, serve food, offer first class seats, or carry air freight. Putnam grasped that adding any of these services would complicate the process of getting the planes turned around fast. All the 10X company's SMAC recipes contain things not to do. Do not use loss reserves to manage earnings at Progressive. Do not wait to develop perfect software to enter the market. Get good enough to launch and then improve. Microsoft. Do not be the first with new innovations, but also not the last. Stay one fad behind. Stryker. Do not cut R&D during industry recessions. Intel. Do not hype. Better to make people angry by underestimating your next success than by overestimating. Amgen. Do not grant stock options to the CEO, but only to employees. Biomet. The clarity and specificity of a SMAC recipe helps people keep their bearings and sustain high performance when in extreme conditions. Let's go back to David Brashears on Everest. Over the years, leading up to the IMAX project, he developed a SMAC recipe for filmmaking in the high mountains. He went to a 50-degree below zero freezer in Toronto to develop specific protocols for handling the IMAX camera in extreme cold, assessing how the batteries would perform, and practicing loading the 65mm film with bare hands. See, because even on the top of Everest, he had to load the camera with bare hands to minimize any chance of malfunction. He created an idiot checklist for working and moving the camera in extreme conditions and unusual situations. He systematically developed a supply list that eliminated any weight that didn't directly contribute to the IMAX project or to safety. He then refined all his methods on a 160-mile, 28-day trek in Nepal the year before the Everest descent. By the time he and his team were filming on Everest, they knew exactly what to do and precisely how to do it. On May 23, 1996, Brashears and his team stood on top of Everest with the IMAX camera. One mistake, a dropped piece of camera equipment, a malfunction, a bungled film feed could wipe out years of effort and millions of dollars expended. We worked slowly and methodically, just as we had for the past 60 days, explained Brashears of the crucial moment. Barehanded, I threaded the film again. Then, at the apex of the world, Robert and I went over our camera checklist one last time. Smack. Let me share with you some of the elements in David Brashears' smack recipe. And just listen to this and see how it's very similar to Putnam's 10 points. Very different environment, but it has that recipe feel. One, create a binder with individual tabs for all facets of the expedition, including backup plans and sometimes even backup plans to the backup plans for everything that can plausibly go wrong. Two, perform the idiot check every time you move locations. Conduct a 360-degree spin to make sure you haven't left anything behind. Three, thread the camera with bare hands, no matter how cold, to ensure a perfect shot every time. Four, be able to assemble the camera, mount it on the tripod, load and thread the film, aim and shoot in 5 minutes flat. Five, test all equipment in real conditions, sub-zero freezer and simulation trips before the actual expedition. Six, always optimize weight and functionality. Carry the least amount of mass without sacrificing function or safety. Seven, in selecting teammates, choose people to get stranded with. Eight, always bring backups for critical gear and supplies, extra oxygen, extra crampons, extra mittens, and extra supplies. Be prepared to stay longer than planned. Nine, never let a weak member attempt to summit. A team is only as strong as its weakest member. And 10, have two separate teams, climbers and filmmakers, that work well together on the mountain. In a world full of big, fast-moving forces and unrelenting uncertainty, 10Xers accept with stoic equanimity what they cannot control. Yet they exert extreme control when they can. One of the most crucial ways they exert control in an out-of-control world is by being incredibly smack. The more unforgiving your world, the more smack you need to be. A smack recipe forces order amidst chaos. It imposes consistency when you're slammed by disruption. Operating in a turbulent world without a smack recipe is like being lost in the wilderness in the middle of a storm without a compass. Now you might be thinking, okay, I get the chapter. The primary finding here is to have a smack recipe. But in fact, the existence of a recipe per se did not systematically distinguish the 10X companies from the comparison companies. Rather, the principal finding, and this is the key part of the chapter, is how the 10X companies adhered to their recipes with fanatic discipline to a far greater degree than the comparisons, and how they carefully amended their recipes with empirical creativity and productive paranoia. So now we're back to the triangle. You have the fanatic discipline to adhere to the recipe, and you have the ability to bring empirical creativity and productive paranoia to bear for amending the recipe. Adhering to the smack recipe with fanatic discipline. The 10X companies kept any given recipe ingredient in the mix for more than 20 years on average, with a range from 8 to 40 plus years. Durable indeed. We found a fascinating contrast in the comparison cases. Most of the comparisons displayed some version of a smack recipe during their best years of performance. Only one comparison company, that being Kirshner, never had one at all. But the comparisons changed their recipes to a much greater degree than the 10X cases. When Morton and I disaggregated all the recipes and analyzed 117 recipe elements, ingredients, if you will, across the 10X and comparison cases, we found that the comparisons changed 4 times more than the 10X cases. Let me go through the specifics. So we're looking over the entire era of analysis for each company, and I'm going to tell you how much the smack recipe changed for the 10X company and how much the comparison company changed its smack recipe. The percentages here are a little bit approximate, sort of rounded to about a 5%, but they'll give you the basic idea. 10X company, Amgen changed its recipe 10%. Genentech, the comparison, changed its recipe 60%. Biomet, 10X company, changed its recipe only 10%. For its comparison company, we can't say because it's the one comparison that we never found a smack recipe. Intel changed its smack recipe as a 10X company 20%. AMD, in the same industry, changed its 65%. Microsoft, during the era of analysis when Microsoft won big, changed its recipe 15%. And Apple, during its comparison era, when it nearly killed itself, changed its recipe 60%. And we will return to how Apple got back to its original recipe under Steve Jobs a little bit later. Progressive, 10X company, changed its recipe 20%, compared to Safeco, which changed its recipe 70%. Southwest Airlines changed its recipe, as we discussed earlier, about 20%. And PSA changed its recipe 70%. Stryker changed its recipe 10%, whereas its comparison, USSC, changed its recipe 55%. Now, just pause for a moment and just reflect on this. We deliberately studied chaotic, rapidly changing, full of disruption, turbulent, unstable, unpredictable environments, environments that are just characterized by constant tumult and change. And yet we find, at the smack recipe level, much less change in those companies that won. That's just fascinating. We wouldn't expect this. We didn't expect this, but we found it. Now you might be thinking, okay, but wait a minute. Perhaps the comparison cases had truly inferior operating models. And they changed more because they hadn't yet found a great one. Ah, but think back on PSA. Recall from Chapter 4, the Bullets and Cannonballs chapter, how Southwest Airlines began as a copy, even a photocopy of PSA.